The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic I'd like to explore with you tonight is the topic of perception. And just briefly, of course, we'll talk in more detail, but this is the function of the mind that labels or recognizes or names an experience. It's a pretty common word, and it has meanings in other fields like psychology. So we'll be looking at how perception is understood in the teachings of the Buddha and why it's very important for both our conditioning and for our liberation. So perception is a function or an activity of the mind, and the Pali word for it is sanya. The mind quite naturally recognizes and adds a label to our sense experiences like seeing and hearing and touching. So, for example, we hear some pitches in a particular sequence and the mind says, bird. You know what that is. Or we see a particular pattern of shapes and colors in vision and the mind says, tree. We don't think about it, right? It's just there for us. So it's the creation of a concept. Perception could also be called conception or conceiving, the act of conceiving. And it's important to realize that there is an active component to this. It's not only that something has a certain quality or is a certain thing and we just passively perceive that, receive that in some way. There's actually some input from our own mind, and we'll be talking about that in more detail. So perception itself is pretty simple. It's that very initial moment of recognition, and it's distinct from the whole story and associations and other things that immediately often follow a perception. Although I'll qualify that a little bit to say that that line is not always totally clear, where the end of the recognition is and the beginning of all the associations that go with it. So as an example, to make that a little bit clearer, recently I was down in the basement and I opened the closet door and there was a scorpion on the middle of the floor in the closet. And I got to watch my mind with this experience. It was quite interesting, actually. So I opened the door, and there's the scorpion. And perception reliably delivered the word scorpion into my mind, right? And so I knew what it was. And then that wasn't really what I was focusing on. I was actually looking for a mop. And so I kind of went on, like, oh, so where's that mop? And then I had to back up. I'm like, wait, what did you say? Scorpion? And so I had to look. I think I had to look three times. And each time I got the word scorpion. But it took me a while to kind of put that together and figure out, okay, I have to stop what I thought I was doing and I have to deal with this. And I really do have to deal with this. So it was kind of a process where it was clear that the label that went on what I was seeing was distinct from all the other stuff because there was this kind of gap between them where I didn't quite know what to do with that. But despite its simplicity of just providing the label or the image or however it is that you think, perception is of tremendous importance. It's the mind's interaction with the world. It's the interface with the world. And it's actually where the freedom can be found in a lot of cases. I don't think it's a stretch to say that Buddhist practice is largely the retraining of perception. The world remains as it is, but we learn to see it differently. Or more precisely, we stop misperceiving, which is what we often do. And we'll see a little bit more how that happens also. In particular, we see that things change and we see that they're not so personal. For those of you who like a larger theoretical framework, I'll add that in the overall picture of Buddhist understanding, perception is one of what's called the five aggregates, which are domains of experience. You know, we can divide up the whole pie of experience into these five pieces, and perception's one of them. The others are form, which is physicality, feeling tone, whether things are pleasant or unpleasant, mental formations, which is all the stories and other things, and consciousness. And perception is the fifth of those. Actually, it's the third in the middle. And it's the clinging to these five aggregates of experience that is the cause of suffering in most cases. So that's kind of the overall view, that the 10,000-foot view. But let's go back to perception as a function. How does perception work in the mind? So perception picks up features of an experience, and it collects them into a label, and then it remembers that label for future use. So it's related to and reliant on memory, which is a very interesting component of perception. We teach children, actually, to perceive in certain ways, right? We hold up the cup and we say, cup, and the child, you know, learns. And this is totally necessary and normal and fine for the social and relational world. It's very important that all of us have some common public understanding of what certain shapes and sounds and sights are in order that we can relate to each other and have a functioning society. So perception happens at the point where the mind meets a sense experience, you know, sort of the contact with the mind or the body. And it works by matching to a known template or to a pre-existing category. You know, that's the memory part. So this is not that abstract. It's actually, we can witness the memory component of perception quite easily. If we experience something for which we don't have a close match in our memory, you can watch your mind be stumped briefly and then fumble towards making the closest match. So, for example, Rebecca Bradshaw is an insight meditation teacher, and she tells a story of one time when she was sitting out by a lake, meditating out in nature, and she was just sitting there peacefully, and she heard this crackling, sort of popping, vibrating sound behind her. And she was a little bit surprised, and she watched her mind kind of go around in a circle for a moment, and then it delivered the phrase, water running over rocks. That was like the closest thing that her mind could match. This was perception, closest thing her mind could match to that sound that she had heard. And so she thought, well, that's kind of odd. And so she turned around, and a small tree behind her had fallen. And that had been the sound of all the branches sort of crashing against the ground. Luckily, it fell in a direction that didn't come to, you know, right on her. But that was, you know, that was sort of the best that her mind could do, was to say water running over rocks. And I'm sure we've all had an experience like this. You know, you look at something and you just can't grok at that moment quite what it is, and you get something into your mind, and then you have to look again, or you have to look more carefully, or you have to ask what it is. So this gives us an entry point for noticing perception if we haven't really observed that before, thought about it before. Often we notice perception when it fails or when it doesn't happen so quickly. Also, in meditation practice, sometimes perception is used. The practice of mental noting is understood to be exercising the function of the mind that is sanya, or that is perception, right? We just gently label each experience as it happens. Labeling is, in fact, the name of this activity, and that's exactly what perception is. So we may have been using it all along and really, you know, actually be connected to what it is in our practice. But the challenge with perception is that it's unreliable. It's pretty unreliable. We often misperceive. The classic example of this is the snake and the rope. You know, you open the garden shed and the rope is coiled up there on the floor, and the mind says, snake. And you can actually feel fear. You know, you can, your heart rate may go up, and then you look more carefully, the light comes in, and you say, oh, it's just the rope, right? And there's a different response. There's also the example that Gil tells where he was training in Thailand and walking through the forest, and there was a big branch lying across the path, and he stepped on it, except that it was a 10-foot snake. So it goes the other way, too. So it's pretty humbling, actually, to start seeing the degree to which our mind is misperceiving things. We're not so innocent. We are projecting, in a lot of cases, onto what we're seeing and hearing and smelling and so forth. So a mindfulness practice reveals this quite clearly over time, especially if you're looking for it. So I'll give a few examples of how perception is related to other things that are going on in our minds or in the environment. In particular, perception is conditioned by all kinds of emotional filters. So, for example, we may habitually see the world through a filter of fear. We walk into a room and we immediately look at the people and we figure out who looks scary and who looks safe. Or we look at what's happening in the room or the objects in the room and we discern, you know, where's going to be the safest place for me to be or how can I slip in and not be noticed, something like that. Or desire, you know, we walk into a room and we see everything that we like. Oh, everything that we can get. Who might we talk to that will be interesting for us? You know, what can I get out of this? So these filters that are habitual in our minds very much condition what it is that we see. You know, what do we perceive out of all the things that are there? In addition, perception is highly conditioned by intention, by, this is related, by what we're looking for, what we've been told to look for. We literally don't see maybe what we've been told, what we haven't been told to look for. There's a wonderful example of this. You may have heard this. It's been around a few times, but I love it anyway. There was an experiment done where people were asked to watch a short video of people passing a basketball around a group of people, and their instruction was to count the number of passes. I don't know, it was a 1 or 2 minute video, and they were just passing it from person to person. And so they focused intently on their task and were busy counting. And it happens that in this film, a person in a gorilla suit walks through the middle of the circle of people passing the ball. And they just, you know, they just pass it around the person in the gorilla suit. It takes maybe 10 seconds to pass through. And when questioned after the words, you know, first they asked how many times was it passed, and people said 82 or 83 or whatever they had counted. And then they say, well, did you see the gorilla? And almost nobody saw the gorilla. And they said, oh yeah, a person with a gorilla walked through that film, you didn't see it. And they would show it again. And it's very obvious when you're then looking for the gorilla to see this gorilla passing through. And people would say, no way, no way, that was not the same film. But it was, that was what they had been shown, and they literally didn't see it. So this should inspire at least some healthy skepticism about what we might be seeing as normal reality. What might you be missing or misperceiving? Do we ever think about what we're not seeing? It's interesting. I think this is why we have to hear the Dharma, actually. We have to hear about the Four Noble Truths or we're not likely to perceive them. So I've talked about what conditions what we perceive. But in addition, perception conditions things. And in fact, it heavily conditions feeling, the feeling tone of things. So one example is that we may be trying a new snack that our friend has given us. It's chocolatey, crunchy, we like it. We say, this is great. And they say, oh good, it's chocolate-covered ants. And that changes the feeling tone for us. So, or maybe another example is acquired taste. I actually, for much of my early adult life, I didn't like tea very much. It just didn't really appeal to me. But, you know, in the Dharma scene, you have to drink tea. So I have to say that I like it now. And I'm sure the tea isn't really different, but the feeling tone of it has changed somehow. Some other conditions are in place. So, you know, this also tells us that the feeling tone of something, the vedana of it, is not inherent in that experience any more than the perception is necessarily inherent in the experience. So I hope I'm starting to point us toward this interaction between the mind and the external world. So understanding that perception is so heavily conditioned can lead to the understanding that perception is always limited. So it always applies only under certain conditions. So for example, we see a tree, but if we walk closer and closer and closer to it, and then we get really, really close with the microscope, we start seeing atoms and molecules, and we don't see a tree, right? Tree is, as a concept, is only relevant at certain distances, certain scales. So being able to apply a certain label or concept depends on other conditions being in place. So when we don't realize that perception is conditioned, then we tend to live with a particular delusion that's called the perception of solidity, or also called the delusion of permanence. And the problem with concepts, or one property of concepts, is that they don't change, right? We say, this is my arm for yesterday, for today, for tomorrow. But we also know that every 7 years, all the cells are completely changed in our body. So this is obviously not the same arm. It certainly doesn't look like the same arm that I had 35 years ago, for example. But the concept is the same. I would still say this is my right arm, right? So the concept is there. And it's again, it's a useful concept. It's true enough, but it's not necessarily the exact reality, right? When you really look at other features. So the problem with this, it's no problem most of the time for referring to arms and such, but the problem with it is that we may subtly believe that this is referring back to something solid and unchanging, that this is the reality, the concept is the reality. So we can cling to perceptions that are related to people also. Strong identification with things like ethnicity or gender or age. These labels are true enough, and they're sometimes useful, and they're sometimes very relevant. They can have a big effect on our lives at certain times, but they're not worth reifying and solidifying if our goal is freedom. It's not the same thing. So meditation is a game-changing factor that can start to undermine these fixed perceptions that we carry around. It reveals in particular that things change, sometimes quite rapidly, which pulls the rug out from our belief in solidity. And this, again, is not something that's terribly abstract, particularly in meditation. You can check this out in your own experience. Next time you feel something that's, say, a pain in meditation, we may feel the pain initially as something that's very solid, you know, a mass of unpleasant feeling, basically, and we fixate on that as pain. We call it pain, it's a solid label, abstract. But if we approach it with a little bit of mindfulness and, you know, begin to explore more carefully exactly what is happening from moment to moment in the place that feels painful, often we'll be able to see that there are changing sensations happening there. You know, it's actually a flow of little experiences, little senses of stabbing or tingling or something else, burning maybe. And it's not continual. There are breaks in between. And it's also maybe confined to quite a small area, 1 square centimeter, 1 cubic centimeter or something, but that may move around. So we begin to see, oh, wait a minute, that solid pain is actually somewhat dynamic, changing in some way. A further example is that perception naturally changes during meditation anyway, especially during the development of concentration as our mind begins to settle. Just any kind of calming. We may begin to have experiences of the body where it changes shape. You know, it may feel very large, or it may have boundaries that we suddenly don't realize exactly where the boundaries of the body are. And for some people, this can be a subtle experience, or it can be a dramatic experience. And it's possible to sort of run off with this and assign a lot of meaning to it, get excited about it, or be afraid of it. That's another response that people have. But that's not necessarily helpful. As we have these other kinds of experience in meditation, we could use them as evidence that our normal way of perceiving the body is not always true. You know, there are other experiences of the body that are possible. There are other options for how we can perceive or put together the world. That can be very powerful. And if we start getting interested in that and kind of hanging out at that point, there's an opportunity for creativity, right? I mean, this is normally a bell, but it could be a bowl, could be a helmet, you know. There's a lot of possibilities. Suddenly the world starts having more fluidity to it, yeah? So here's the big one, the concept of self. So this is the perception that things are personal in some way. So we take this bundle of body and mind, physical and mental experience, and we call it Kim or something else. And we assume, that's not so bad, right? But we assume that it refers to an unchanging entity underneath. But does it? Have we checked that? We assume that there's someone to whom our life is happening, but where exactly are they? If we look, it's a little less clear. So we're not going to go into that in great detail, but talking about it is certainly just a mental exercise. It's not going to be enough to uproot a deeply conditioned concept like the self. But it's important to realize that when a misperception has been happening for a while, it tends to keep happening. So I have an example about that. I think my first experience with noticing perception, although I certainly didn't call it that at the time, was when I was about 7 years old. I used to walk home from school, and part of the walk would be down a little alley, and then I would come around a corner out onto a street. And right at that point, there was a house that had a tree stump in the front yard, a stump of a little tree, and it had a root that kind of curved out from the bottom of the trunk. You know how the first part of the roots at the bottom of the tree are sometimes above the ground. And one day I came around that corner and I saw that tree stump and I thought it was a cat for a moment, because it had the little stump and then the sort of the root curving. It looked like a tail. And then I saw immediately that it was actually a tree stump. And I kind of went on, didn't really think about it much at the time, but the next day I came around the corner and I again saw a cat. And I said, wait a minute, I saw that yesterday, but I know it's not a cat. And it kept happening, like for a long time. I kept seeing that, and I would know, like even when I even thought ahead of time, I know that's not a cat. I would come around the corner and my mind would say cat. And I think this was, you know, I was actually noticing that there was this misperception happening again and again. And I think it's this way with a lot of things, is that once we get that misperception in place, then it kind of keeps recurring, right? And so the groove can be pretty deep if we've been perceiving something a certain way for, say, our whole life. You know, we've got that groove, and it's going to take a while of examining that and noticing it, that it's, you know, not quite correct. We're going to have to see that a lot of times before it really is worn down and doesn't happen anymore. It's very interesting to watch this concept of self, which we're not going to uproot for a while. I was recently on a retreat just a couple of weeks ago, and I was doing walking meditation out in the parking lot. And I was walking back and forth in just next to a row of cars. It was basically serving the purpose of, you know, being one side of my walking path. And I wasn't even really looking at them. And I did this for, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes, a little while. And then this memory floated into my mind. And I remembered that this was the area of the parking lot where I had parked my car. And as soon as I had that thought, so this was triggered by a mental event, this perception, I looked at the row of cars, and the one in the middle was my car, and it suddenly sort of blossomed up out of the row of cars as the one that was different, right? The one that was mine. And so this is, it literally looked different, this kind of the special car. And so this is the function of the mind called my making, or, you know, I making, me making, this process of creating a self, in this particular, in this case, a self that can own a car. So it was really interesting. And then, of course, I couldn't really undo that, right, for a while. You know, I could, you know, that was still, that perception was still operating when I looked at the row of cars. So these examples, though, begin to offer a path for freeing ourselves from perception, from the influence of fixed concepts on our mind, to free ourselves from the tendency to conceive and conceptualize and identify with experience. It's not that we're trying to find some ideal perception. We're supposed to have perception X instead of perception Y. That's not the point. We're actually training the mind to see in ways that are conducive to having insight, in particular, liberating insight. So we're retraining perception. It's possible to perceive in a way that's freeing, that is, to use perception itself to free the mind from perceptions. It's pretty clever. So, in numerous suttas, in the teachings, the Buddha explains that certain perceptions should be developed. That's the phrase. The perception of such and such should be developed. Two in particular that are very important are the perception of impermanence and the perception of not-self. So these are now called characteristics. They're two of the three characteristics. So that's the translation that we use. But my understanding is that in the earlier teachings, these were called perceptions, you know, anicca sanya or anatta sanya. My source for that is Gill, whose scholarship I trust. So originally these were called the three perceptions, and then they later came to be called the characteristics. I think perceptions might be more accurate because they have to do with how we see things, and they're not, whereas characteristic sounds like a quality of an object, yeah. So when we taste salty, for example, we can identify that, we can label that, we know it tastes salty. Is our only response to say that we like it or we don't like it? Or instead, can we practice noticing, for example, the impermanence of the saltiness, so, or the conditioned nature of it? It came about why? Because I put the potato chip in my mouth. It wasn't there before. And then it shifts and changes while I chew up that potato chip, and then eventually it's gone, especially after I have that sip of water afterwards. So it changes, right? It comes, it shifts and changes, and it goes. Actually, there are lots and lots of perceptions that are said to be worth developing. It's not just these two. But the other ones are things like the perception of unattractiveness, the perception of the repulsiveness of food, the perception of abandonment. So if you'd prefer to just stick with the perception of impermanence, that's okay. That'll do you just fine. But there are lots of options. And all of these are said in the phraseology of the suttas to have the deathless as their culmination and their consummation. So this is, you know, the path of retraining perception is a viable path for liberation. So we can begin to see the arising and the passing of the labels themselves. So for example, we can watch, if we're watching our mind carefully and we know to look for this, we can see the birth of fork or tree or Kim, you know, by watching what's happening as we're interacting with the world. It's possible to see, if the mind is very still, that what happens is that a sensation arrives in some way in the mind through a sense door, and almost immediately a matching image is supplied. Where? From memory, right? That's how perception works. And they kind of meet. It's the closest match we have. And that's the way we can relate to and recognize what's coming in. And then the next thing comes in, and the next thing, and there's this perception that gets applied to it. What's important to see about this is that the idea and the experience are not the same thing. You know, that's one of the insights that can come from that. And it's crucial to know and see the distinction between the experience itself and the idea of it that our mind is supplying. See, it's enough to see that. Seeing this naturally, we begin to release our grip on the concepts. When we cling, we're clinging very rarely, if ever, to the real thing. We cling to the concept of it, actually. Perception is likened to a mirage in the suttas. It's an interesting image. If it's useful for you, please use it. I find it useful because it reminds me of the way there's the actual experience and then there's the mind's interface with it, which is the mirage. And that's the part that we can solidify and grab onto. The experience itself is gone immediately, but the idea can stay. And we have to know when that's useful and when it isn't. And we have to see that in order to not have the automatic reaction of clinging. We can even do this process, by the way, with clinging itself. We can perceive clinging when we see it as just clinging. Not my clinging, not the awful, terrible, bad clinging, but this is clinging, this is what's happening. It's a very interesting process. And to know that it will change. You know, we're not going to cling forever. So that's the freedom. It's the freedom is in the relationship and keeping perception very simple in this way. So if you come away from this talk with just one thing, perhaps it could be to place a question mark on your perceptions, your concepts of the world, your conceivings of what's going on, and particularly the concept of yourself. Maybe allowing for the possibility that these things are not so fixed and that they're not so personal. It can really lighten things up and help us to live more creatively, live more freely, and really understand our mind a little bit better also. So you might keep this in mind in the upcoming days as we pass into the concept of a new year. Yeah? December 31st, January 1st, these are concepts. Now, it's useful that we agree, that we all agree that the new year starts on January 1st, because if we all thought it started at a different time, that could be kind of confusing. So I don't think this is a bad label, but it's helpful to know when the concepts are useful and when they aren't. It's also helpful to consider how we use this concept of January 1st. Is it a time that we just become completely unmindful and go to a party? Or is it a time when we say, well, I know it's just a concept, but it's a useful time to set intentions, for example. So take that opportunity. So maybe one possibility of an intention for 2014 could be to loosen our grip on the concepts that aren't serving us very well in our lives. So Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Yeah. Maybe you could wait for the microphone.
I'm not entirely sure how you're defining perception. But if I try to, if I try to understand sort of how the human mind works, it seems to me that sort of by definition, any experience we have is mediated by the mind. And insofar as that's true, if that's true, then the only way we have to experience any sort of sensory data is actually through perception, with or without a label. So there are people who don't have any language, for example, who are still perceiving. So, so anything which the human body takes in is mediated by the mind. Insofar as that's true, everything that we experience is essentially a kind of percept. So if that's true, I just have a hard time understanding exactly what we're doing when we're meditating.
Yes. Thank you. That's an excellent question or comment. Maybe it's both. You're right, first of all, that all experience we have is in some way mediated through the mind, and there is a perception associated with all experience. The five aggregates arise together in each moment of experience. So that's not a problem. It's fine. We're not going to eliminate the function of perception from our mind while we're living. And that's also fine. The challenge is to have perceptions that are beneficial and useful, and to make sure that we're not clinging to the concepts that our mind is creating, because that's where the freedom is found, is in the non-clinging to what's arising. Do you have further... Yeah. I want to make sure I understand what you're getting towards.
So sometimes when I'm reading, I haven't read the scripture, so I guess these are all meta discussions of Buddhist scripture, actually. But sometimes the word true comes up. And I guess I just don't, if it's really about the fact that because the mind is involved and it's a mediator, it's an organ, and so all of our perception is necessarily, in that sense, arbitrary. Essentially arbitrary. It's an arbitrary relationship between our perception and whatever we think of as objective experience, if such a thing exists, and we can't even know for sure whether it exists. I just don't understand. I mean, are we just sort of sorting our perceptions and coming to the realization that this relationship is an arbitrary one, and in that sense, we let go of the clinging? Or is there something that's transcendental, something that's actually true, that we're trying to experience?
I wouldn't say that the relationship is arbitrary. It's conditioned in particular ways, and it can be developed in particular ways. And it has been developed in particular ways to get to this moment. We just may not know how that happened to get here. We always start where we are. And the suggestion in these teachings is that there are particular directions that can be developed that are relevant for finding the end of suffering. There isn't a lot of metaphysics beyond that, at least not in the basic instructions. And the invitation is to try it out and see if it begins to help with that problem. Yeah. And I think it would be a longer discussion to talk more about ultimate reality and how the mind is perceiving that sort of thing. But I think the basics of the teachings are that simple of finding ways to recondition the mind so that it can let go of suffering. Yeah.
Yeah, this is rather daunting because it's like we're all stuck in a perception of the way we see things are the way things are. And everybody understands, I guess, to some degree or another, that they're not exactly as we see things, the way we see things, the way they are. Yet, we operate every day out of a particular reality that we have. And we do the best we can because that's what we got. And I'm always looking for like an end game, and I'm thinking, well, when we get, years ago I was thinking, well, as we climb up the ladder to this state called enlightenment, then our perceptions will be really accurate and perfect. But then I began thinking and looking at various spiritual teachers, and they all have different points of view, even though they're enlightened. And a classic example is you take two highly enlightened people, like Jesus and Buddha, and their perceptions of things are very, very different in some ways. Jesus talked a lot about God and reincarnation. Of course, that part was taken out of the Bible around 500 AD, but that's another story. But Buddha doesn't talk about God or any metaphysical things, and he's basically concentrating on how we're dealing with the physical plane here. What's the best way we can deal with life? And so I guess I'm just finding myself in a giant perception quandary. So any comments you have on that comment?
I think it's an interesting question to... It's easy to be concerned about whether or not we're seeing the right thing, where it's going, all of that, when we start thinking about perception in that way. And I think every religion is essentially a retraining of perception in some way. They may not say it that way, right? But the idea is to offer people a way of seeing. And probably this isn't the time or place to compare the different perceptions that are being trained in different traditions and whether or not that might lead to the same place. Maybe it's good enough to understand that people have realized in many different ways that it's possible to train the mind in a direction that will be helpful for it, train the heart. And there are different options out there. And this one that's being offered by the Buddha has certain qualities that we've talked about a little bit tonight. And of course, the invitation is to explore them more deeply. And always the criterion is to see whether or not they're working. You know, are things becoming simpler in some way, becoming easier, becoming more workable in our lives? And I think any religion worth its salt would offer that in some way. That may be the best I can do at such a level. Does that help?
Yeah, at this point in time, I'd just be happy to move out of suffering into a better space, you know, and then I'll worry about the real heavy metaphysical things when I get into a better space.
But that sounds like a great approach.
I throw that out there for whatever. Huh?
That sounds like a great approach.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm stuck with, so.